I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, a very special conversation with a man that I consider to be a living legend. Ishmael Reed is a poet, playwright, essayist, critic, novelist, publisher, and iconoclast who has crossed paths with such figures as Malcolm X and Bill Gunn, the filmmaker behind the classic black art house vampire film Ganja and Hess. Ishmael Reed is also the author of Mumbo Jumbo, the 1972 novel that is now widely considered to be one of the most important works in the Western canon. More recently, Ishmael Reed has come out as an outspoken critic of the musical Hamilton. He even wrote his own play in response to that musical entitled The Haunting of Lin-Manuel Miranda. In this conversation, which lasts for over an hour, we discuss a wide spectrum of subjects involving culture, literature, the media, and academia. Ishmael expounds on such subjects as tokenism in the worlds of media and literature, his 1990s Washington Post op-ed dealing with the Iran-Contra affairs connection to the crack epidemic, the trope of the black boogeyman in popular culture, corporate influence on our culture, and of course, his critique of Lin-Manuel Miranda's popular musical, Hamilton, along with much, much more. And now onto the conversation with Ishmael Reed. Welcome to Parallax Views, a poet, novelist, essayist, songwriter, playwright, and I would just say all-around iconoclast, Ishmael Reed. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good. And I also want to note that I have my co-host here for listeners, Brian Shaughnessy, who's been on the show before. Brian, want to say hi?
Hey, everybody.
I'm really excited to be having you on the show, Mr. Reed. I guess where I want to start is this idea of the iconoclast, because I think that does sum you up in a lot of ways. Would you consider yourself an iconoclast, and how did you become someone who is willing to sort of challenge a lot of preconceived notions and sacred cows?
Well, I would say that there are a lot of people whose views are not expressed in a media that's dominated by men whose resumes are interchangeable. It's usually Princeton or Harvard. And so there are millions of people who do not see me as iconoclastic, but expressing views that they hold in private.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just reading one of your Washington Post pieces. I believe it was The Ward on the Vine. And I was really curious about that piece because I'm a big fan of Gary Webb and Dark Alliance. And I was curious, what led you to write that piece? Because I had a lot of listeners that wanted me to ask about that.
You mean the piece about the Contras?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I witnessed that. I live in a black neighborhood, and I witnessed that happen and wrote about it. But I think the mass media are reluctant to connect the Gary Webb's research. He wasn't the first, John Kerry, in his subcommittee on narcotics, pointed to three government agencies that knew about the Contras distributing through middle persons cocaine into the inner cities, but were mum about it. The DEA, the State Department, and other agencies knew about it. That's John Kerry. So it didn't take Gary Webb to, he wasn't the first one to talk about that. So Jefferson Morley was the editor at the Washington Post at the time. And he was receptive to my op-eds. But I think that was the last op-ed that they printed of mine. Now, I think a year later, the Central Intelligence Agency admitted that they knew about it and that Gary Webb was on target.
Could you talk about what you saw in Oakland around the time that led you to write about that? And you also wrote a play that dealt with the crack epidemic as well. What was that like in Oakland and your reactions to it?
Well, I moved into the kind of neighborhood I grew up in 1979. And things were relatively peaceful until around the 1990s, when that distribution of cocaine, which was converted into crack, I think by somebody named Ricky Ross in Los Angeles. So I saw these crack houses open up. There were hundreds around the city. And that competition still goes on. I mean, I think that under Ronald Reagan, history's going to catch up with him because all this happened under his presidency. He saw, he and his right-wing promoters or finances and supporters saw the inner city as being expendable, just as this regime has seen Puerto Rico is being expendable. Thousands of people died in Puerto Rico because of this president's spiteful attitude toward the, he got into a spat with the mayor of San Juan. And because of that, he let thousands of people die. So I think they find black and brown lives to be expendable, which is happening now. I think a lot of the whites who are, ignoring the requirements that we wear masks and practice social distancing feel that it's a black problem because blacks and browns are the ones and Asian Americans are the ones who are disproportionately suffering from it. So they find things like that as population control. I had to be cynical. So we had crack houses. This neighborhood changed overnight. I was teaching at Harvard. I came back around 1989 or so. I think it was 1989. And the whole neighborhood had changed. And the person who's my house citizen, it's begun. It's right across the street. So up until about 5 years ago, he had two crack houses operating on this street. And, people, if they don't have any money, they're going to resort to the underground economy, which is what Irish, Jewish, and, Italian, Americans have done in the past before they went, before other avenues were open to them, but people are going to use the underground economy to make a living. So that's what happened around here. And that's what explains the homicides in Chicago and other places. Now, these people who are overrepresented in the media just don't have a clue about what goes on in these neighborhoods. So they fail to connect the homicides in Chicago and other places as war over markets. So we meet with the police and I'll ask the police, for example, whether there's an uptick in homicides in our district. And they'll say, well, because the price of Mexican heroin went up. So Jefferson Morley was one of those white journalists who was receptive to our point of view. But that was last. And now I've had difficulty getting an op-ed printed in the Washington Post since. As a matter of fact, I got a smear. They had to apologize to me. Because one of these honorary black feminists said that Ntozake Shange and I were at odds, they had to go to the into Zaki's family to find out this was not true. As a matter of fact, I published the first excerpt from Color Girls in 1984 in my magazine Yardbird. So, and then there was another op-ed that they had to get clearance from an attorney. One of these, billionaire builders out here in San Francisco was supporting Anita Hill. And I had covered the fact that his employees were accusing him of sexual harassment. And so I'm considered a wild man by some of these op-ed editors. I mean, somebody said I was a wild man, even though I footnote everything. So it's easier for me to get published in a place like Haaretz in Israel, which I've started, like since March, I've been publishing Haaretz in Israel. I can always get something there. El País of Spain, second leading newspaper in Spain, asked me to write a piece about what was going on here with police brutality. Then I had a piece placed in Liberation in Paris. So what I found out, I would have to get a worldwide audience in order to get some of my points of view expressed, because they're not welcome in a lot of places in this country.
I want to get into your experiences with the media more, but one more thing about that op-ed. When you're talking about the Vine and, you know, conspiracy theories that may arise in Black communities, I think it's interesting, you know, I think there is a reason to have paranoia at times when you look at things like Tuskegee, or even, you know, when people attacked Reverend Wright so much for that sermon he gave after 9/11, I just thought to myself, well, if you listen to the sermon, what he was saying was true. There is this history of oppression, and I feel like there is an attack on anyone that dissents. They're labeled as cranks or conspiracy theorists, when really, I think there is a reason to be questioning the establishment.
Yeah, well, the establishment has a lot of conspiracy theories. For example, there's this right-wing outfit called Manhattan Institute that jumped on me recently. Their little racist rag city journal. They have a conspiracy theory that racial profiling doesn't exist. So I would consider that a conspiracy. You know, you live in a country where mass hysteria traditionally is bound to break out in any minute. So my new novel, I'm sending off today, The Terrible Fours, which I call book three of my apocalyptic series, Terrible Twos, Terrible Threes. This book is The Terrible Fours. I began with a conspiracy theory promoted by the Puritans and people like Sir Walter Scott, that the devil took up his abode in the United States, in America, and that at the triumph of Christianity, Satan and the Native Americans fled to this country. So that's how I start my new novel, which has a lot of conspiracies, theories in it that are promoted by the establishment. And as a matter of fact, the last installment, which was published in 1993, Terrible Threes, predicts the rise of Donald Trump. I think that our points of view are the public intellectuals, the Black intellectuals who get by, or whom they choose, they might end it at Tuskegee, but their experiments that still go on, which has been documented. For example, I found out last year that they were conducting leprosy experiments at Attica without the knowledge of the prisoners. So this goes on, this continues. This Tuskegee's only a tip of the iceberg. And if you go to the Village Voice, you can find that story. Somebody stumbled upon it accidentally, where they found a research paper that had made references to a leprosy study prisoners of Attica were being used as guinea pigs in a leprosy study. So at one time we had a powerful Black press, and you know what was, we were able to, let's get back to Grapevine Telegraph. That's a expression that comes up in Booker T. Washington's Up From Slavery, for which I wrote the introduction. I think it's Signet. I think Signet was a company. And he talked about the Grapevine Telegraph. So now the Grapevine Telegraph for Black intellectuals and scholars and others is places like Facebook, the social media. So I get a lot of information that I would not ordinarily get in the mainstream press or the legacy press from Facebook and Instagram, places like that. So people send you articles and they send you stuff that you might not have noticed. Now, we had a powerful Black press at one time that was so powerful that the government wanted to, I think these FBI and other places wanted to charge them with sedition for being pro-Japanese. There were more pro-Japanese groups in the Black groups than communist groups in the 40s. As a matter of fact, Elijah Muhammad, the leader of the Nation of Islam, was tried with sedition because he was considered too friendly to the Japanese, the Asiatic Black man. You know, so that press lost its potency because the Black nationalists and other groups demanded that the mainstream press send Black reporters and journalists. So now we have Black journalists. Some Black journalists have become proxies of places like. I won't mention any of the names, but they're considered Black. They're considered Black media, but they're actually owned by people like Time Warner and all this.
I actually wanted to get into that. You know, you've mentioned that when you were getting into writing, you had, I believe, a socialist say to you, "Oh, you have to go uptown. You have to get uptown patronage." Can you talk a little bit about the issue of patronage and sort of how the sausages are made within the media and publishing world, because it's not all about just raw talent. And I think a lot of people get sort of thrown by the wayside that have immense talent because they didn't know the right people.
Well, that's how it started out. If you go back to New York Times, if you go search Before Columbus, I'm pretty much well canonized and placed in the establishment, if you look at my resume. But if you go, I think you go to the archives, and it's still available. You find where when we began the Before Columbus Foundation, and we had our first American Book Award ceremony at the West Side Community Center in New York. I think it was 1980. The New York Times asked, "Well, you're pretty much in the establishment, and why are you beginning this?" I said, "Because other people, there are other people that who are ignored, who write better or write as well as the tokens." And what happens is that the New York literary establishment, depending upon its whims, promotes tokens or proxies, which has been happening for 100 years. You go back to Claude McKay. What happens is that's the New York literary establishment or some North and Eastern group will sponsor a token, and then the token rebels and they get somebody else. That seems to be the pattern. So Claude McKay was adopted by the socialist downtown, Max Eastman, and a magazine called Liberator. Claude McKay wrote Home to Harlem and Banjo and another, and they just found a novel that was lost. But Claude McKay came from Jamaica and settled in New York. And so he was adopted by Max Eastman, the socialist. And the task of the token is to criticize the those writers with whom the sponsors have problems. So he first was assigned to attack the Black nationalists. And there's always an argument in political movements in this country between those who say class first and those who say race first. So, you know, which is the most restricting factor in everyday life in America? Some say race, some say class. Black nationalists say race. People like Bernie Sanders and his group, they'll say, it still goes on. I wrote a play about it called The Final Version that others say race. So what happened was that he was attacking the Black nationalists. His job was to attack the Black nationalists in Harlem. Then he went to the theater, according to a biographer, and to do a review of a play. And they told him to sit in the balcony. And he went back to Liberator's office and found that they were not interested in his being wounded by racism because they were into class. They had Mike Gold, terrific writer, Jews Without Money. That's, man, that's a terrific book. They got into a conflict. So Mike Gold was in class. Claude McKay was for race. He lost. He got, I don't know whether he got fired or resigned, but he began to be sponsored by the Catholic Church because he found the Catholic Church was more sympathetic to his feelings of being slighted because of racism. And here's another problem. This is why Blacks are suspicious of progressives. Back to what happened in the 1930s. I covered in my play, the final version. The progressives can always go right on you or go anonymous. So Max Eastman, who was a social liberator, he ended his life writing for the National Review. Or David Horowitz, who was like an honorary Black Panther. I don't know, I think he got seduced by a book about the Rockefellers or something. I don't know what happened to him, but he's now to the right. And so, you know, it's always been a problem. So then you updated to James Baldwin. Now liberals, I mean, I think whites are not all, don't have any incentive to find out what's happening to major cultures that are, you know, near to them, you know, occupy the space with them. And so James Baldwin had to do the same thing. He was adopted by the Partisan Review crowd, the anti-Stalinists of the Partisan Review, who had a problem with Richard Wright, who was, there's always a rivalry between Chicago and New York. So you had these proletariat writers like Richard Wright living in Chicago, the John Reed Club. I think they got into a fight over who was gonna get money from the party. And William Phillips, who's the editor of the Partisan, went modernist. So, you know, they, T.S. Eliot, that's, you know, modernism. Robert Frost said, I love The Wasteland, but there's not a single original line there. There's a
collage. Well, I was going
to. But let me finish on this point. William Phillips had a problem with Richard Wright. And said he became anti-American. You know, he saw him in Paris, and Richard Wright was making, you know, he was getting an audience by attacking racism in the United States. Of course, when he attacked the French, he was persona non grata when he turned on his sponsors. So Baldwin was, Everybody's Protest novel was published in France. And then William Phillips used that essay to go after Richard Wright. Then Baldwin had to do in Chester Himes, he had to do in Langston Hughes, he had to do in a whole bunch of rivals to arrive at the top of the heap, okay? And then when he attacked members of the family, Lee Strasberg, an actor studio in his novel, Tell Me How Long the Train's Been Gone, they jumped on him. And so Mario Puzo was hired by the family to attack Baldwin in the New York Times Book Review, and which is an organ of the family. And they got Eldridge Cleaver. So that's what I was trying to, and the last, let me sum up. We began the Before Columbus Foundation. We found hundreds of writers that are ignored by people east of the Rockies, because the idea in Manhattan is if you reach Buffalo, I guess, you drop off the end of the world or something. I mean, this. And we found that every generation has great writers because of the power and influence of a segment of American literary culture. One at a time gets promoted and the others are not read.
So I was going to say in that regard, and I want to kick it over to Brian if he has any questions. But first, I was going to say, I think that issue in literature, you can broaden it out to the media system and the academic system, where a lot of the Black voices seem to be getting chosen by, you know, these sort of white overlords. Or, you know, I think you can argue that people like Steven Spielberg have been exploiting issues within the Black community, trying to make, you know, money off things like the Keller Purple.
I wrote a piece in The Tablet, which is a Jewish American magazine. It's a very good magazine called The Tablet, challenging Steven Spielberg to do a Jewish American version of The Color Purple. But at the same time, some of the women who write for The Tablet were complaining that Jewish producers don't give them the roles that they're supposed to get, go to Gentile women. You know, they were saying that Mariel Hemingway, that character originally was a Jewish American character, and they chose Mariel Hemingway. So my point was that if they did do a Jewish version of The Color Purple with Nicole Kidman play Celia, I was tongue in cheek, you know. Because I've been to Israel a few times. I've been there three times. As a matter of fact, Nathan Zack, who invited me, he died. They had an obituary of his, one of the great writers. His obituary was in Times last week, but he invited me to the International Poetry Conference there. And so I understand the condition of Israeli women and women in Jewish American, Lilith. I read Lilith, you know, which is a Jewish American feminist magazine. They say it's a problem. All of these groups have problems. My point was, I had to go into exile because my point was that Black guys get singled out. So, you know, for example, Caitlin Flanagan, who's a good writer, I saw her on a Bill Maher's show last week or so. And her father tried to get me tenure at Berkeley in the 1970s. I finally got it. But she wrote a piece for Oprah talking about how terrible Black men were toward Black women. And I wrote and challenged her. I said, well, you know, an Irish guy's going to write us a manual about how to treat women. He said, but anyway, she answered. She said, well, I don't know if it's a problem. I think it might be a problem in Ireland.
Well, it's like when people are very silent about, you know, Philip Roth, you know, like, oh, well, Philip Roth was a great writer. But I mean, some of the stuff he writes, you know, I would think that it would make people uncomfortable.
Yeah, well, the feminists have attacked him, and when asked whether he cared about it in Esquire, he said, F the feminists. Now, if I said that, I would have to leave the country, you know, because we get singled out. No, I think that Black guys definitely get, I mean, you know, white women are not the only ones who do that. You know, they voted for Trump again. Majority of white women that voted for Trump once more. I guess you have to treat them rough. I don't know why that is, but they're not the only ones. We had a problem with a woman of Indian ancestry. What happened was Black feminism made money for everybody with Black women. You understand? It got co-opted, just like Black Lives Matter got co-opted. I'm looking at Black Lives Matter. I'm looking at George Floyd and, you know, his picture and everything. And all of a sudden, it's sponsored by a gas company or, you know, you know, so they co-opt. So Black feminism has been co-opted. You know, other people making money, like Steven Spielberg, the guys who did What's Love have to Do With It, and all these other guys who have become all of a sudden honorary Black feminists, like the guy who hit me in the Washington Post. And, you know, it's been a big moneymaker. The Help, white guy, you know, directed that film in which this white American writer studied the Black feminist formula and made more money than they made. She made $38 million. I don't think Alice Walker made that much money for The Color Purple. So it gets immediately co-opted. So this Indian woman who did a thing called Beauty is Truth and Truth is Beauty or whatever about Alice Walker, in which I play the heavy. I'm in there. You know, they have my footage of me in there saying, like, lesbian love is wonderful or something. I don't know what it was. It's out of context, right? She's got Indian ancestry. women in India, slaves. They have female children, thousands of them as prostitutes. I'm saying, well, why don't you take that on? Because they know in some of these authoritarian countries, they know what they get. I mean, you try to be a feminist in Pakistan or someplace like that, you have to go into hiding. So what they do is they dump it all on the black guys. That's what I found. That's what I've observed. Not that black guys can't be creeps. They can be creeps too.
Well, the core of your critique has never been that black feminists are wrong about everything. It's been that, there's a problem with turning black men into the scapegoat boogeyman.
My last six awards have come from black women. But nobody cares about what they really cares about what they think. But I mean, I've gotten reward from, different places. Most recently, I was honored down at the Zora Neale Hurston Festival down in Orlando, Florida. Lorna DeCervantes, a great Chicana poet, has a tribute to me on YouTube. And I published a lot of them. I published Joy Harjo 40 years ago. She's now U.S. United States poet laureate, Mamie Bursenberger. I published her in the 70s, and she was nominated for the National Book Award this year. So I published a lot of them. So, but I get my problems from people who are afraid, women who are afraid to critique, the male members of their ethnic group and their attitude towards women. Or we get our critique from corporate feminists, like the ones who, well, I don't know what you think about Bill Cosby, whether you think he's guilty or not, but he's sure to get railroaded. They'll jump on Bill Cosby, but nobody is insisting that the names in Ms. Maxwell's or into Epstein's diary. He's got a black book.
Yeah, his black book, yeah.
1,000 names. And when it got to court, they redacted the names. Okay? Which I think the QAnon would love that, because they're saying that, the establishment would have pedophiles. Maybe they have a point. But those names are redacted. So they protect the court. People like Joy Reid, I like her show. She's a black feminist. And she pointed out, some misbehavior of a man on another channel or something like that. I said, you got people at NBC where you work. And the following week, Mac Halpern was exposed. These guys have been doing sexual harassment at NBC since the 80s. I mean, Bob Teague, I don't know if you remember him. That's a long time ago. Bob Teague was a black reporter for NBC. He wrote a book called Live and in Color, I think it was. I have a copy of it. And he talks about sexual harassment in NBC in the 80s. Carol Simpson, also a reporter, talks about being molested at ABC and these other places. So while these women are on, they have a little ghetto. CNN and NBC, MSNBC has a little ghetto segment or a little ghetto zone on the weekends. They let the black and the Hispanic and all of them, do their stuff. They get time to do a little show. Every other day it's business as usual. But see, you got what I call corporate feminists. They jump on guys who can't talk back, but they don't critique the misogyny of their employers.
Brian, I want to give you a chance. Is there anything you wanted to contribute at this point?
Not so far. Just kind of taking it in. I think you've asked any question I would have asked already. So,
well, I'm curious, Mr. Reed. How do you think that is there a way to sort of break through the different industrial complexes, whether it's the literary industrial complex or the media industrial complex, so that we can actually have a true diversity of voices rather than, chosen by the sort of corporate elites?
Well, if you go to, I think we're going to be on C-SPAN shortly, our American Book Awards, you'll see faces that they ignore. And we have Penn Oakland. We're doing our ceremonies out on the Penn Oakland Awards. We're doing our ceremonies on December 5th. And we gave Omarosa Newman an award because, a censorship award, the Gary Webb Censorship Award, because they're trying to shut her down. this administration. This administration said that the media are the enemy of the people. So we have our war ceremony. We just don't get the coverage, except for America Book. We don't get the coverage that the Manhattan Book Awards get, the corporate book awards. So they know about our existence. I mean, when we did awards in New York, the New York Times covered it. Like the first award was at the West Side Community Center, as I told you. The second award, Joe Papp of the Public Theater sponsored us. We had Toni Morrison. We had Donald Barthelme, the late Donald Barthelme. We had Hugh Masekela, the great South African trumpeter. We had Howard Sandman Sims, the great hoofer. We had a big show. And they covered that, and they covered several since then. But when we do stuff on the West Coast, we don't get covered. So I think there is a politics of book awards. And we've been affected because none of the people that we gave awards in the past, they have accepted. For example, Jericho Brown, we're the first ones to recognize him. And he got an award this year or last year from the National Book Award. So, they, you know, we have sort of like put influenced them or pressured them to diversify. We're part of PEN America, and I don't want to say that. But anyway, we operate on a shoestring budget. We don't have dinners where a millionaire can have a writer sit at their table. Or we don't do ceremonies on yachts, you know, in New York Harbor. So, you know, we're sort of like a pro. As a matter of fact, the Times, I don't know whether I said that or not, that we're the blue collar PEN. In America Book Awards, also, there are people from diverse backgrounds and from the working class. And we have two United States poet laureates, one former, Juan Felipe Herrera on our board. We got Marlon James, who got the Booker Prize. And we have we had the late Rudy Anaya, who died within this year. We got a Presidential Medal for so the writers see us as a writer's award. For example, Gloria Naylor and Edwidge Danticat and others have come to our ceremonies at their own expense. Matter of fact, Edwidge Danticat brought her family, brought her mother and father. Don DeLillo, who rarely he came to pick up an award that we gave in Chicago. John A. Williams, a lot of people. So we're really the writer's award because we have writers. Determining, you know, the selections. For example, our president is Wajahat Ali, who was on the CNN payroll, but now he's contributed to the New York Times Book Review. So I don't know what it is that we don't get the kind of coverage in New York. As a matter of fact, I might say that the New York Times the Book Review tried to subvert our awards.
How so?
Well, you know, let me give you a backup. We began the American Book Awards at the West Side Community Center in 1980. Later that year, the establishment came up with something called American Book Awards. Okay. Ken McCormick, who was Eisenhower and Truman's editor at Doubleday, grand old man of letters, was my editor before I left Doubleday. And I called him. I sent him a note saying we had the American Book Awards. And that we had it first, you know, like David against Goliath, right? He called me up and told me he didn't want to get me into trouble. That was on a Friday night. At the time, I had a Park Avenue lawyer who's deceased, who was Leonard Bernstein and Aaron Copeland's lawyer. So the guy, you know, he had some heft. And he called them and told them that, you know, they had to back off. So first they wanted to, I think William Buckley was one of these people with Ken McCormick. First they wanted to hire him or they wanted to make some, and Elliot Fremont Smith wrote in the Village Voice that we should have the name, but it became a moot point because later they dissolved. And we have carried the name since 1980. So New York Times came up with an article saying the short-lived American Book Awards. You can find that, the short-lived American Book Awards. They're talking about the Ken McCormick Buckley thing, right? I contacted the writer. I said, "What do you know? We have the American Book Awards. You guys are aware of it because you covered our events." He said he was told by higher ups not to mention us.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I can send you his name if you want to talk to him. And so I said, well, you know, here we are out here having to make the budget and everything. It's been a struggle. And they dumped this on us, you know.
I was going to say, do you think that this disconnect between the sort of establishment and, you know, just the people's voices, I think it's caused some real issues across the board that you bring to light in some of your books. For instance, you know, a lot of people were shocked in the media when the Tree of Life shooting happened. And yet you were pointing out back in the 80s that there were these groups like the Order, these neo-Nazi groups that were anti-Semitic, that there were people cheering for them in the towns they were from. It doesn't sound like you were caught off guard by the rise of Trumpism in the way that some media figures were. You were paying attention.
They're mollifying those people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I got a piece coming out, Mother Jones, where I talk about how the New York Times is beginning to look like ebony. If you look like, it looks like a black magazine, I mean, I pick it up, except for the editorial page, where they have these guys who think alike, have interchangeable resumes. I don't know whether Bret Stephens is Jewish or not, but he certainly is missing the story when he tries to blame anti-Semitism on some black group, or tries to mollify these people, that we ought to apologize to Trump and Thomas Friedman. They try to babysit these, what's his name? Bob Woodward. I think it was Bob Woodward. One or the other. I get them mixed up. Bob Woodward saying, you know, these are decent people. On the day that these guys with rifles slung over their shoulders tried to disrupt a voting registration thing in Virginia. You know, so what they're missing the point is that and I said, well, you know, maybe I wrote a thing to the Times, maybe these guys ought to get out of New York once in a while, because you'll find that these groups are growing. And the FBI just issued a report saying that, you know, anti-Semitism, hate crimes at blacks, Asian Americans, you know, because this guy talked about the China virus, the 1900 attacks on Asian Americans. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine, a filmmaker in New York, was attacked by some guy, that all these things are happening. And these guys on, like David Brooks and all of them, they just seem to live in a different world. They don't seem to be in contact with reality. Now, I was in the incident you're talking about. I was in southeastern Washington. I think it was Pullman, Washington, around there, on the day that the Order got its martyr. This guy got into it. I think his name's Matthews. He got into a shootout with the FBI. And people who were, my host said the townspeople were on his side, and the Order. And, you know, you read the Turner Diaries, which the media don't cover, you'll see that this is a blueprint for all these guys going out. Timothy McVeigh was inspired by the Turner Diaries. People don't read it. In the Turner Diaries, blacks and Jews are exterminated. These guys are acting that out. And so you get these upper class writers on the op-ed pages of the New York Times, you know, like babysitting these people and saying we ought to try to understand them. And Timothy Egan wrote recently that, you know, he could understand they've been humiliated. Somebody said they've been humiliated and all that. These people are out for blood. They want a fascist dictatorship.
I was going to say in that regard, I've always found it interesting that there is this attempt to coddle some of these far right wing white nationalist figures. And then on the other hand, I see people that get really upset about a figure like Louis Farrakhan. And I don't agree with Farrakhan's views on everything, but when he says something like, I remember the one time he said something that really resonated with me, which was that when the Philly heroin epidemic happened, no one cared. And it was, you know, oh, that's, they're not being responsible. People should stop doing drugs and make something of their life. But then when the opioid epidemic happens to a bunch of white people, you know, then it's a health crisis. And Farrakhan, whether we agree with his prescriptions for what should be done, he is pointing out a real double standard. But you don't see people pointing that out. You see people coddling these white nationalists. It's very bizarre to me.
Well, you know, Brett Stevens, I think, mentioned Farrakhan. This is the second time that the Times has blamed black people for anti-Semitism, yet no black person has shot up a synagogue or a Jewish nursery school or any of those things. But they, I don't know the obsession, but first it was a piece by Henry Louis Gates, which said that, you know, blacks were the last remaining anti-Semites in the country. Anti-Semites, that's what you get when you're living in Cambridge, I guess. And I wrote him an email saying that ADL, at the same time of his article, said that anti-Semitism on black people had declined. And he said, well, don't worry about it. They're going to do a follow-up where they talk about Jewish American racism. That never appeared. So now we come back, Act Two, where they mentioned Farrakhan. I think it was Brett Stevens in the same article. And I mean, what happens is that these guys are omniscient. They have to speak for all of us. You know, you have gays who are not, people who are not gay, they speak for them. You know, Christoph had a thing talking about what we can learn from Hispanics, which some Latinx people I know found amusing because these are all kind of different groups. You know, some are prosperous, some are poor, you know, so they have to cover everything and they make mistakes. Now, I did a book called The Complete Muhammad Ali, which sold well in Canada because it was published at Baraka Books in Montreal. I can get on CBC, I can get on the network in Canada, CBC. And in it, I interviewed people from the Nation of Islam. Farrakhan's influence in Nation of Islam has been reduced and diminished. I don't know whether he knew that, but I mean, you know, I guess he convinced his editors that he knew what he's talking about. When I get stuff published in the New York Times, they fact check me to death, you know? But anyway, when Elijah Muhammad died, you know, 1974, he abandoned this thing about the evil of white people. I think when Kennedy was shot, they had a change because they didn't want to get in confrontation with the government. But Elijah Muhammad had his sons, Wallace and his other son, train in Orthodox Islam, okay? He knew that he was popularizing Islam in order to gain followers. I said, why do you guys have all this comic book stuff in there, flying saucers? And he said, well, that's somebody I knew, I interviewed, said, well, that's how they got the masses. The masses could not digest the Quran. And so what they did was they had to substitute stuff that they're acquainted with, okay? But Elijah Muhammad knew about Orthodox Islam, and he had his sons trained. Now, this is something that Brett Stevens didn't have incentive or was too lackadaisical to explore. When Wallace Muhammad, his son, took over, he got rid of some of those people. He said that his father was teaching comic books and that you should, you know, preserve everything that he taught that had something to do with Islam, but disregard all the other stuff. And at that point, Farrakhan broke off. And, you know, what I've been told is that his power has been diminished. So this is a problem that, you know, you hire somebody like because of the lack of diversity on the editorial page, you have people who can say, make any kind of remark they want to make and make any assumptions about other groups without having the knowledge or the information or the facts.
You know, in that regard, I was wondering, what do you make of the sort of media interpretation and writings around Malcolm X, who you had met? What's your sort of take on Malcolm X and the way the media has portrayed him over the years?
Well, he's dead. I mean, they like Muhammad Ali now. People like people who are, they like heroes who are deceased. Martin Luther King, you know, they hated him when he was alive. They're still trying to destroy his reputation. There's some FBI tape that's coming out in 2027 about Martin Luther King encouraging a rape. I guess they want to take his holiday. You can take back that holiday or whatever they're obsessed with him. So, you know, they like dead heroes. They liked Muhammad Ali when he was, you know, had these disabilities. They dug that. So the same thing with Malcolm X. Malcolm X has been mythologized. And they have their story. The Nation of Islam, people who at the time were members of the Nation of Islam, had their story. They raised questions about his reputation. But I think what they're interested in mostly is that Detroit Red episode. They're really interested in Malcolm X as a sort of like a wannabe pimp and player. And what I tried to do in Malcolm and Me, I don't know if you saw that in Audible. I got 2 bestsellers at Audible, Malcolm and Me, and I just sold The Fool Who Thought Too Much, which takes place in late 1700s Germany. That they got that. Outselling Fauci. But this is, you know, but anyway, what I try to point out in my interpretation of Malcolm X was the intellectual side. That it was remarkable that he knew more than we did, and we'd gone to universities and we thought we knew everything. I mean, but he was such a genius that he was able to absorb a number of books or read a number of books while in prison. And that's because the philanthropist gave the prison where he was located over 1,000 books, okay? And I think he read all of them. I just read in the paper today where they're trying, somebody sent me a petition where some prison is trying to remove books. The books, I mean, a better person. I remember two prisoners, one ex-prisoners. One was Latino and one was Black. They had master's degrees and they said that they didn't know who they were. That's why they went to jail. And then they read up and they got degrees. So, you know, but anyway, that was the most important part of his career. That's what attracted me, Malcolm X, as the off-campus scholar. Now, we're talking about these academics who are being chosen by the media to... They got tired of Rap Brown. They got tired of off-campus intellectuals. That's what happened there. They got tired of radical white students. That's why they raised it. They got tired of SDS, and they got tired of Black proletariat off-campus intellectuals, okay? So that's why, you know, working class, we wouldn't have Black studies out here without working class white students, because Bobby Seale, I interviewed him. He took a syllabus that he made up by reading books to the president of Merritt College, and the president dismissed him. But when the white students threatened to close down the school, that's how we got Black studies out here at Merritt College, at least at Merritt College. So that's why, you know, they brought these academics in that you see on MSNBC and other places where you need like a post-colonial glossary or a feminist glossary to understand what they're talking about.
And it's not necessarily connected to, you know, a common language. You sort of have to be in the club to understand what they're saying.
In the academic club, which keeps changing. You know, I covered an MLA conference down in San Diego, Modern Language Association, and I wrote a journalistic piece on a panel which had my books under discussion. So this deconstructionist panel was packed, couldn't get in there. So I asked these professors whether they had a better knowledge of deconstructionism. They said, I don't. They admitted they didn't know what it's all about, but don't tell anybody. But I mean, these are fads. So they got this little academic clique and they get hired by magazines and, you know, I mean, you go to Atlanta Monthly. We can't compete with the Atlantic Monthly, which is now sponsoring tokens. They got $1 billion. I think that's Steve Jobs' wife.
Do you also, I'm just curious, do you think this is also true of other sectors? Like, I know you were a big champion of Bill Gunn, and I think that Ganja and Hess is one of the great sort of art house vampire movies. But no one, he's sort of forgotten by a lot of people. And I feel like there's that barrier in Hollywood where Bill Gunn was seen as too intellectual for the Hollywood set. There's all this gatekeeping, in other words, well, in all these different.
he's hot now. I published his first book. I published his novel, Rhinestone Sharecropping, with my partner, late Steve Cannon and late Joe Johnson. And now it's selling. There's a revival of Bill Gunn's work. And also I'm going to publish his first novel, which is about the young people around, like James Dean and all these people around the Actors Studio. He wrote a novel about that. So he's hot now. He did Personal Problems for us, which is considered a classic, and now is being is part of Criterion, the Criterion Collection, and it's gotten great reviews. New York Times called it an unorthodox work of art. So I mean, we did that for $40,000. He did. I think he had a budget of $100,000 for Ganja and Hess. So I think that a lot of the younger black filmmakers feel that you can't make it unless you go to Hollywood. And they do not realize that we've had a black film tradition since the 1900s.
What do you think the impact of, you know, gatekeeping or the creation of cultural glass ceilings or, you know, unless you know the jargon, you can't be in the club. What do you think the big negative downside of all of this is? What is the biggest impact you think it's had on our society?
Well, I think that it's an abandonment of common sense, and it promotes a craven kind of a competition. I mean, I see these guys fighting it out in New Republic and these other magazines, which is like, you know, blacks going at each other. I don't know if you read Black Boy. Richard Wright's Black Boy has a scene where this guy's employer gets together with another employer to see if the two black bucks can fight each other. And that's still an entertainment for liberals in New York, like the Richard Wright Baldwin thing, and you got a couple of guys going at each other in New Republic. And
New Republic, I think, were the ones that promoted Murray's book for a while, Charles Murray.
Sure did. Well, Atlantic Monthly was first. Mm-hmm. The Atlantic Monthly brought Pat Buchanan, read it, Bell Curve, and showed it to Reagan. So the Atlantic Monthly, which is now liberal, I guess, or neocon or whatever, then Andrew Sullivan. I had to write this guy in the New York Times, had a very affectionate piece about Andrew Sullivan. I don't know if you read my piece called The Tragedy of Stanley Crouch.
Yes, in Counterpunch recently, yes.
Well, you know, there was this guy at the New York Times just wrote a long affectionate piece about Andrew Sullivan. Andrew Sullivan promoted the bell curve at the New Republic, I guess with the blessing of Perez. I don't know if he still owned the magazine at the time. And people resigned over that. And if you go to Wikipedia and other sources, you'll find the bell, even the Manhattan Institute, this right-wing racist thing, you know, recently called me an old timer, right? I said, well, listen, if you guys would stop accepting money from the tobacco industry, maybe some people would have lived as long as I lived. But anyway, the Pioneer Fund finally financed the bell curve, and it's a Nazi outfit. They don't make any, it's a Nazi outfit. As a matter of fact, the founder was interested in race betterment. He was some kind of New England industrialist, and one of his friends was hanged in Nuremberg. So this doesn't come up, but so why is Andrew Sullivan such a sought after, you know, commentator and public intellectual after signing on to this stuff? Why don't he just join the good old boys? What those guys are, or Boogaloo?
I was going to say too. What fascinates me is when you really read Murray and his stuff, he's really into this idea of the creative minority. And you have all these Irish and Italian Americans that sort of have been assimilated into the idea of white that, you know, Murray's whole creative minority doesn't like those people either. It's very odd. And you've written about that as well.
Well, you know, Benjamin Franklin called Scots Irish white savages. And that's a merge group. So, you know, I think a lot of these people, as you say, are trying to get away from their origins and become assimilated. And the way you do it is join up with, you know, places like Manhattan Institute and go Anglo, get into the Anglo mainstream, which is the way it promotes it. So, but in the process, one loses one's heritage. Now, I have some Irish ancestry, and I don't think that's a big deal, because the Irish were like they were the white poor. We talk about crackers. We usually talk about Celtic people. We talk about crackers. We talk about Celtic people. So Bob Callahan was the one who converted a lot of us. Late Bob Callahan was Irish American, and he was responsible for the Irish American Renaissance. It occurred on the West Coast here. That the British were the first to introduce plantations into Ireland. One of the poets I published was Oscar Wilde's mother, Lady Wilde, about the British taking away the food from Ireland and the famine and the suffering that it caused. So I was invited to an Irish American writers' conference. And I asked the question, was assimilation worth it? And none of the people said it was worth it. They said they had to marry Anglos and they could, you know, they had all kinds of sacrifices they had to make to be less Irish. So that's the Faustian bargain that comes with assimilation, is that Italian Americans no longer Italian Americans and Irish Americans no longer Irish Americans. They're white, and which is problematical. And like my friend Dan Cassidy, the late Dan Cassidy, who wrote a book called How the Irish Invented Slang. He takes on H.L. Mencken in the American language, said the Irish made no contribution to the American language. And Dan Cassidy said he had students with names like Fitzgerald, had no clue what that meant. Now, I'm not saying everybody should go ethnic. You know, we're Americans, but people should try to understand where they come from. And I think what I've read is that the whites are the least interested in their origins because they're embarrassed. When the immigrants from Europe probably were more literate than they were. They just used the oral tradition. For example, Mike Gould, I mentioned him, Jews Without Money. He said his father could tell a story that lasted 2 weeks. So there's something he said about the oral tradition, but these people are ashamed of their origins. And so what they do is they go white. I don't know and now they're all taking opioids and you know, all this kind of stuff and tranquilizers and pills and everything. And I think it has something to do with the lack of knowledge of where they came from. I mean, that's just, you know, a simple analysis.
No, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think there's a lot of values that got lost for Italian and Irish Catholics, especially. I know we're running up against the hour. I just had one more thing I wanted to ask you about, and that's the haunting of Lin-Manuel Miranda, which I really appreciated your criticism of Hamilton. And I was actually offended by the way some people tried to frame your criticism. I was watching a Vice TV segment on your criticism, and it was titled, "This guy hates Hamilton so much." And I just thought to myself, what do you mean by this guy? You wouldn't say that about, you know, Steven Spielberg or someone like that. But what I wanted to get into was what led you to write The Haunting of Lin-Manuel Miranda, because I think it's a really important play.
We have to take on people who mistakenly or deliberately classify slave owners as abolitionists. That was the problem with that. And they had Annette Gordon Reed, who did something on Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson, who told them that he was not an abolitionist. And then they changed his story to, well, he was opposed to slavery. Well, he wasn't opposed to slavery. When the Haitians revolted against the French, Jefferson and Hamilton sided with the French. So he was involved in slave trade all of his life. And so I felt a little vindicated when, within the last month, the George Schuyler historic site in Albany put out a piece where they had receipts where he sold slaves and bargained slaves on the behalf of the Schuyler family. So it was in the New York Times. As a matter of fact, it was, I could tell you that, just look it up. It's the most recent thing about Hamilton, where I only scratched the surface. I mean, and the point was that I got a worse treatment on, I got a better treatment on The View with Bazar than I got on Wait, Don't Tell Me, which is like pseudo intellectual thing that they have on NPR. They really gave it to me. None of those people had seen the play.
I was going to say what's interesting about the play is you don't really attack Lin-Manuel Miranda. In fact, there's sort of a redemption moment for him. If anything, the villain is Ron Chernow.
Yeah. Well, that was a conclusion made by the Schuyler Historic Site in Albany, that it was Chernow. Chernow never replied to us, but he replied to them. And he said, well, you know, what about his good side or something? I said, well, it's like praising a serial killer for helping old ladies across the street. You know, it's all messed up. What's happening is that the official historical establishment is crumbling. They got Meacham. Meacham's on every day. He's like the official of his, because I guess he looks like a historian or whatever. He's the one who said that Andrew Jackson was imperfect. He's the guy that slaughtered. I had this piece that's, I think Mother Jones is going to publish, where he slaughtered he caused 390 blacks to be slaughtered in Spanish territory in Florida. It was Spanish territory. He thought that the fugitive slaves who escaped and set up this port with the Choctaw were giving other slaves a bad idea, were giving them ideas. And so he had this fort bombarded, killing 390 men, women, and children. We know him for the Trail of Tears, but we don't know him for that. This guy was like the Eichmann of the Native American and Black problem. Meacham calls him imperfect. And then Meacham said that slavery lasted 90 years. And then he corrected himself, said 100 years. So, I mean, so what's happening is that women were the first ones to critique the Hamilton thing. Like Michelle DuRoss, brilliant job. She took on those historians who called them abolitionists one by one. I said, it reminded me of the afternoon that George Foreman fought four or five guys at the same time. You know, it was devastating. And then there's Lyra Montanaro and Nancy Eisenberg and others. They were the first ones. But they wrote in obscure journals, except for one piece in the Huffington Post, out of the way journals. I brought it to the stage where it got attention. So the official historical, as a matter of fact, I said the American Historical Society ought to apologize for all these historians who praise killers like Robert E. Lee and all of them. One of my recent books is called Why No Confederate Statues in Mexico, where I talk about Robert E. Lee and all of them down there in Mexico slaughtering Stonewall Jackson, Jefferson, down there slaughtering innocent Mexican men, women, children.
I want to let you go because I know we went the full hour here, but do you think the silver lining in all of this, or if there is, I always like to try to end on maybe some kind of positive note. Do you think the crumbling of that establishment and the sort of cracks in the veneer, we have people questioning these things more? Do you think there's hope for more of that in the future? What's the good news?
Well, they seem very nervous. I mean, here's Timothy Egan said, he can understand why, the Trump people are upset and that political correctness is ubiquitous. I said, you the guys who are ubiquitous. I mean, we can't get a word in edgewise. You got Bill Maher complaining about political correctness. He reaches more people in a week than all the black Native American scholars, under radical white scholars reach in maybe 100 years every week. So here are the people who monopolize the freedom, the so-called freedom of expression, money, monetary freedom of expression, complaining about they can't get a word in edgewise. They're being, boycotted on campuses. There's a guy I know who's on TV every morning who works at Princeton, and he's under fire there because some professor said everybody's going to play. I said, you look at the Princeton catalog. The studies devoted to what Americans call Western civilization, I guess that doesn't include algebra, right, which is trigonometry. But anyway, the studies devoted to the faculty devoted to Western so-called Western civilization is bigger than General Motors. You pick up any random college catalog, you know, you see that. So what I mean, they've seemed very paranoid, the word they apply to us. So I guess the diversity people are making it inroads.
Well, I want to thank you, Ishmael Reed, for coming on Parallax Views. Anything you'd like to say to my listeners, how they can keep up with your work, or any words of wisdom for people that want to do the type of work you've been doing?
Well, I like people to – my books are not getting bought, so I like to get people to buy – we got – except for Audible, which has Malcolm and Me and my The Fool Who Thought Too Much, I recommend that one. People love that one. And my book of poetry came out a couple of weeks ago, Why the Black Hole Sings the Blues. And my novel, Juice, which was despised in this country, is illustrated. I illustrated Juice. So if they look at it, I hate to say this, you can go to independent bookstores, but if you look at Amazon, you see all my stuff there.
And anything you'd like to say to my listeners when it comes to writing, or just any words of wisdom you would have for them in their own endeavors?
Well, I think if you write in a variety of genres, you never get writer's block. So I'm sending my novel off today, and now I can get back on a assignment from Authors Guild of America about writing about the plague. So if you write in a variety of genres, you never get writer's block. That's what I would say to them.
Well, thank you again, Ishmael Reed, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Ishmael Reed, truly a living legend in our time. And there will be an after show posted with Brian Shaughnessy, who sort of listened in on our interview. You may have heard him on the episode itself. He didn't get a chance to say as much, and I don't think that's because I didn't let him, but he sort of wanted me to keep going with the role I was on during the conversation. But we had a little bit of an after-show conversation about the interview, and I think listeners who subscribe to the Parallax Views Patreon page at the $5 tier will enjoy that. Speaking of which, producers' credits are due for my $10 and $15 tier subscribers. So with that in mind, shout outs to Amelia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Ted, Zach, Gratz, Mickey, Chase, and Holland. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tier of my Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.